Argument, Mullen versus Gettinger, Mr. Stegall.
Thank you, Judge Posner. From the police station in Section 1983, we now go to the university. This is a First Amendment motive case arising out of Western Illinois University. The issue, Ann Mullen was a faculty member there, a senior professor of art. A professor, Jan Klo, had a faculty student gathering after hours.
If you're going to go through the facts, your 10 minutes are going to be up.
Just while you,
so
you know,
let me ask
thanks.
You a question.
Please. That's why I'm here, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Other than the timing, what is Ms. Mullen's best evidence that any refusal to correct the Marr report was related to retaliation for the November 17, 1997 letter? In other words, what is her evidence of causation and where would we find it in the record?
Well, the time gap is 1.5 semesters. I've got a timeline here because, as you know, universities, Western's there for 16 weeks. The gap does the letter does it starts in November 17th, but the aftermath is February 22nd. So that's the whole spring semester, and the lead time on assigning classes is a year. Well, in 98 spring semester, after this came to a close at the end, he assigns classes for the next year when she's on sabbatical. So she comes back in the fall. Nothing, the Butts don't follow up on their complaint about.
In other words, your argument is that was the soonest they could punish her.
Yes.
Okay.
Practically.
Now, is there any evidence in the record that the university ever certified more than 300 days of unused sick leave to sewers for a retiring employee?
Not that I know of. The only there is evidence that SERS wrote them a directive and told the provost's office, Sandra Murphy, not to send us certifications on employees for whom you don't have records. Exactly who Ann Mullen was, pre-1984 employees when the 300-day limit started.
Okay, but the answer's no, right?
The answer's no, but they knew they didn't have any records and shouldn't certify. So what happened is after that, these people, I don't know how many days they had. After that, she said it came up when people had transferred to another university, and Sandra Murphy stopped sending certifications because they says pre-1984 we don't have any records.
Now, if we agreed with the district court that Section 27.7 caps sick days at 300, and they offered her 300 days when they were trying to settle her grievance, what are her damages?
Well, that's the whole case. That's exactly it. We wouldn't be here if Section 27.B capped her damages. That's the whole case, and that's the strongest evidence of motivation. Why don't you send two accountings to SERS? And let's
say it again.
Why don't you admit what you know to be true? Your records aren't accurate prior to 1984. You've got a report with 16 years of nonsensical entries. Here, sirs, here's what our records show. Here's what Mullen's done. You figure it out because they're the one who made the ultimate decision. That's another fatal point in the instructions. The jury should have been instructed that it's SERS that determines how much she gets. That's the strongest evidence. Why would these men continue to say, no, we won't even admit what we know to be true? And throughout trial, contrary to what they say in the brief, Gettinger and Wittiun and Stifler said that this Marr report was accurate.
How many unused sick days do you think she has?
608.
608?
Yes. In the service credits, Your Honor.
And you think she would have gotten credit for that if it hadn't been for this retaliatory...
Well, I'll put it this way. She certainly can't get credit on what they sent.
Don't put it... Don't be vague.
I'm sorry.
You think that if it hadn't been for her complaint about this whore comment, she would have gotten the 608 days credit?
She's sui generis. I don't know.
Yes or no?
I don't know. Don't know. Right. She was the only one who ever raised it.
Okay.
My answer is that you conclude factually I really can't answer it because it's only happened once, which shows she's unique.
You can't answer it. You can't answer
it. Yeah, the evidence is...
You don't know. You said you don't know.
All right, I don't know.
So now talk about something else.
Yeah, well, the other point I wanted to make, another compelling proof...
It's such a tempest in a teapot.
Well, no, it isn't, Your Honor, because
this business about the casus belli here. So... Doesn't the context make clear that this unfortunate use of the word whore does not have a sexual connotation? It refers to, you know, artists prostituting themselves for the market, right? So why make such a big to-do about it?
Because she didn't do what any human being should do, is say, I'm sorry, and shouldn't have done it. Because to this day she got up in trial and said, I didn't do anything wrong, and she wasn't apology then. That's why. What she should have done...
In the last case, we were dealing with a serious problem. People jailed for months. Here we're dealing with a most trivial kind of misunderstanding that must occur every day in every university in the country. So
Your Honor,
swells into a federal lawsuit.
Well, but Your Honor, academics, there's always these fights. And
yes, fine. Now, why? There are always fights. Yes, academics are irritable and resentful and so on. So why does that have to come into a federal court?
Because she has a constitutional right to write the president.
The Constitution is preoccupied with triviality.
No, the Constitution is preoccupied with speech. That professors who call students whores, undisputably, the price was the debate between the other one, should be reported to the president.
That's an accurate characterization.
Well, it certainly is from the evidence.
The point she's making is, you know, it's this question: do artists work, solely for the intrinsic satisfactions and of art, or to contribute to culture, or do they have mercenary motives? If you talk about that, that doesn't mean you're accusing people of sexual misconduct.
Your Honor, there's evidence that this is an after-hours party where she's drinking, and she knew she'd been raped, and calling her a whore in a loud voice. I'm sorry, I don't think it's an intellectual discussion. Nobody in the university thought it was. Mullen heard about it because it was the talk of the department.
Seen a case like this before? I have just a vague recollection. Has there been other cases growing out of this incident?
There was a Title IX case totally unrelated that the investigation I used for inaction, deliberate indifference.
Didn't we hear that case?
Yes, and you said Title IX.
The same silly.
No, it wasn't. It was sexual.
Rise to a second case.
No. The policy of tolerating sexual harassment gave rise to an actual incident of sexual harassment over a long period of time by a professor in this department. This report was important because they did bring in people in the investigation and found out all sorts of things are going on here that shouldn't be. That faculty were propositioning students. So it was very important because it uncovered a pattern of inaction, and they certainly thought it was a pattern because the university ordered sexual harassment training for all the faculty in the art and music department. My case was in the music department. And there was an individual arrest.
I remember now.
It was reversed point. That was the Title IX point I lost on, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Stiegel.
Thank you.
Mr. Blitz?
Good morning. My name is Assistant Attorney General Carl Elitz. I'll be appearing on behalf of the defendants, both the university and the college defendants, although the Professor Mullen is challenging the jury's verdict in favor of the college defendants. That's the chairman of the art department and the dean there.
But Mr. Elitz, to your knowledge, has the university ever certified more than 300 days of sick leave?
Your Honor,
hundreds of people have to have retired, and some of them have worked at the university, I would imagine, as long as Dr. Mullen. And I can't imagine that this is, you know, the first time that this issue has come up.
Your Honor, it's my best memory of the record that there is no evidence that anyone has ever received more than 300 days of sick leave certified to CSRS. I believe it was Mr. Stifler who testified that there had been a thousand people that he had seen retire, and that Professor Mullen was the first one to ever challenge her sick time.
How many unused sick days do you get? How many sick days do you get a year?
I believe in the most recent contract provided 1.75 per month, Your Honor. So the math on that would be
days. Or it's per 9 months.
I believe there's 9 months. There's
so
a dispute, 15, I think.
15 days, 16 days a year. So if you worked for 20 years and were never sick, but maybe people decide to use their sick days whether they're sick or not. But you could imagine a person accruing more than 300.
It's possible, sure.
Well, what is this? Is it just a policy? You get to 300 and say, that's plenty.
No, it was a negotiated term in the contract. I don't think it matters for my
but
purposes.
I thought you said if no one ever got more than 300 days, and yet it's reasonable to think that some people would have accrued that amount of unused sick leave, doesn't that suggest there was some policy of some sort capping this at 300?
Yes, Your Honor. The collective bargaining agreement does that. It says that if they'd earn more than 300, they could keep it, but they wouldn't earn more. And if they were less than 300, they could earn up to 300 until they came back down, and they could earn back up to 300.
Mr. Elitz, on page 16 of your brief, you quote two statements by university employees that seem somewhat inconsistent with your position on the 300-day limit, so maybe you can help me. First, Parker testified that Professor Mullins would have needed 900 days of sick time to retire earlier under the basic formula. Christy Huth testified by deposition that she had never seen anyone retire with more than 800 sick days. So how could anyone retire with 800 or 900 sick days if no employee could ever have more than 300? I mean,
I can answer that, Your Honor.
Did the court err in instructing the jury that she could never accumulate more than 300 days for any purpose?
No, Your Honor. The employees you're talking about are CSRS employees. They're not the university's employees. CSRS is the system that governs all of the university's retirement. The contract that we're talking about here governed the employees at Western, and the collective bargaining agreement in place here was one for the Western employees. It limited them to 300. There were other employees in the system who could have more than 300, but not at Western. So Professor Mullen was a Western employee. She was under that particular collective bargaining provision, and that's why some of the witnesses who worked for CSRS said that they had seen people retire with more than 300. In fact, I believe that's part of the plaintiff's theory. They wanted Western to go to CSRS.
It is very confusing, isn't it, if you have, you know, these people testifying to that. I mean, it certainly is apples and oranges.
I think that's what the plaintiff wanted the university to do, to say, well, we have this provision in the contract and we think it limits people to 300, but we're not sure. You figure it out. But the law in Illinois is that the university had to certify to CSRS how much sick time the employee was entitled to receive under the contract. And the two witnesses or the two defendants that were in the certification phase for the university, Witun and Stifler, were only willing to certify 300. It was their interpretation of the provision that's in dispute that 300 was the maximum amount of time, and that had been a consistent interpretation. And my major point, and the point I think that should carry the day in this case, is there's nothing tying that belief to this letter that Professor Mullen wrote 28 months before. The critical time period isn't even the 28 months. I think the really critical time period is when the grievance gets filed, and the two university defendants who are at issue now on appeal, they take the case, and they don't even look at the grievance. They say, well, you know, Professor Mullen, you're getting close to retirement. Instead of pursuing this grievance, this very contentious art department, consider retiring. She says that's a great idea, and they spend 11 months working on this, having meetings, talking about records, looking in archives, trying to figure out what her number should be.
Well, the difference is a lot of money.
Yes, and I'm not
It's more than we get paid in a year.
No doubt that this means a lot to the professor. But my point is simply that the administrators, who are sitting in a different building, I assume, at a different time. They're not in the art department that's going crazy. They're sitting in the administration offices. They get this woman coming to them who they've known, I assume. She's been there 30 years. They say, how about you retire? And they spend 11 months working with her on her retirement plan, and they can't figure it out. And finally they say, we can't do what you want us to do. You should file your grievance. And she says, this is because of that letter. They say, one letter. They knew that she had written this letter because she had filed the grievance. It was all part of it. But they weren't spending any time talking about her letter. They weren't the defendants that were in the art department. That was Defendant Gettinger and Butterworth. Those were the ones that were in the art department. Well, these defendants were very far removed from that. And so I don't think there's anything connecting that letter to the decision by these administrators to give her what they perceived was the maximum amount allowed under that agreement. And that's my argument, Your Honors. I think we can parse out the language. I think I'm not giving an inch on the interpretation of the contract. I think 300 days is the maximum under that agreement. But so what? It's really what they believed in good faith was the number that should control, because they can't retaliate if they do what they believe they should do. And that's why I think the court should just focus on the causation issue and affirm the jury's verdict.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Ellis.
You very much.
Mr. Stiegel, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
1 minute? Thank you. I talked with my clients, my consultant. There is evidence in the record that showed one professor in the early 80s, when the limit was 270, earned 282 days of sick leave, called the Griesenbach accounting, and it was sent to CSRS because he protested and said, you got to go back and make my records. So the one who did, who actually looked at this. Now, the problem with his argument on causation is they refused to talk to anybody about the contract or the accounting. Western has in-house accountants. Bring them in. They know how the system works. They had counsel who was going to draft a release. They never asked him for an interpretation. No lawyer has ever interpreted that contract other than me. And that is strong. Why would they do that? Why wouldn't they just tell, Dan Slack of CSRS, general counsel, offered to come meet, wrote Witun a letter and offered to come meet? No, we're not meeting with you. He knew there was a problem, and by the way, Witun heard, was on the committee who handled the Butterworth investigation. He certainly knew about the letter.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Stiegel, Mr. Ellis. Next case.